We begin this evening at Mountjoy Jail.
In Dublin's big town, there are first-class hotels where they give board and lodgings to all those big swells. There's blinds on the windows and bells on the doors and a beautiful carpet laid out on the floor. But the grandest of all is now work in full swing. It's a beautiful building controlled by the king. I was there once myself and I'm able to tell. There's no digs in Dublin like the Mountjoy Hotel.
Mike Hanrahan there performing Mountjoy Hotel, a song written by Irish volunteer Phil O'Neill in 1918, which gives an ironic take on the lodgings provided at that prison. 100 years ago today, on Easter Monday 1920, a core group of 36 Irish volunteer prisoners in Mountjoy pledged, quote, not to eat food or drink anything except water until all here have been given prisoner of war treatment or are released, unquote. Joined by others in the days that followed, the Irish Independent reported that by the 10th of April, the number participating had climbed to 101, the largest scale on which this form of protest had ever been attempted. And throughout the year 1920, the protest continued to spread. To talk about this, I'm joined now by Dr. William Murphy, lecturer in modern Irish history at DCU and author of the book Political Imprisonment and the Irish, 1912 to 1921. Well, you are very welcome to the History Show. Can you set the scene for us in 1920, first of all? Why were there so many Republicans in prison?
Well, Miles, very important to this is the fact that conflict had been gathering pace in Ireland, really from the late summer of 1919. Collins and his squad had begun to direct attacks against the DNP, for instance, from late August. The IRA campaign against the RIC was gathering momentum and switching from intimidation to violence. So this increased activity on the part of the IRA obviously brought a response from Dublin Castle and the British state in Ireland generally. And that led to increased numbers of arrests. Those who were being arrested were either being held for trial in Ireland, civil trial, or increasingly at this point, court martials. But also in November, the cabinet agreed to begin to use limited internment without trial again for the first time since the 1916 rising. And small numbers of men were arrested and deported to Britain and interned without trial in Wormwood Scrubs beginning in December. And those numbers were growing through the spring of 1920.
Now, talk to us a bit about the use of the hunger strike as a tool of political protest in the years up to 1920, and then the culmination with this mass hunger strike in Mountjoy Jail in that year, in 1920.
Yeah, well, I suppose the hunger strikes in Mountjoy are part of the second great wave of hunger strikes that marked the Irish Revolutionary period. Irish nationalists themselves had borrowed really the tactic of hunger strike from the suffragettes who had deployed it from 1909, first in Britain and then in Ireland. And when the Irish nationalists really began to use it very effectively as a method was in the autumn of 1917. Most famously in that era, you had the Thomas Ashe hunger strike in Mountjoy, which resulted obviously in his death and the aftermath of his being forcibly fed. And there was a very big wave of hunger strikes through autumn 1917 and into the early spring of 1918, into March 1918. That wave of hunger strike led to a series of victories, really, as far as the prisoners were concerned, a whole series of releases, particularly as the state abandoned forcible feeding after Thomas Ashe's death. Eventually, in March 1918, it succeeded in bringing that wave of hunger strikes to a halt, really using a carrot and a stick. The carrot was they agreed an ameliorated regime for Defence of the Realm Act prisoners who hadn't committed a violent crime. And the stick was they effectively issued a stop or starve threat to the prisoners. So they said anyone who goes on hunger strike from now on will not be freed. They will not be forcibly fed, but they will simply be allowed to carry their strike to its logical conclusion. So that led to an end to that wave of hunger strikes, but it started to build momentum again in the autumn of 1919, when initially individual hunger strikers began to resume the tactic, and then they found that the British state seemed to have unlearned the lesson it had learned in 1918, and at first it released individual prisoners, and then There were a couple of bigger successful hunger strikes in October, for instance, 1919 in Mountjoy, when over 40 prisoners were released after a hunger strike. And so this second wave of hunger strikes begins that culminates in Mountjoy in April 1920.
And did the IRA leadership sanction the tactic of the hunger strike, or did the impetus come from within the jail itself?
The impetus really does come from among the prisoners themselves. Officially, the official IRA position is that they are against hunger strike. They issued an order in early 1919 telling their prisoners that they shouldn't hunger strike and they should instead pursue other strategies for disrupting prison regimes, like coordinated protests of sort of disobedience of the rules. They were perfectly okay with prisoners, for instance, organising escapes. They were perfectly okay with prisoners rioting. But you know, the prisoners themselves began to drift back towards hunger strike, particularly when they saw that individuals had success with it in the autumn of 1919. And there are certainly mixed messages, I think it's fair to say, coming in from the outside. So the GHQ, General Headquarters of the IRA, are prepared to tolerate it, even to tacitly approve of it, if they think it's going to be successful, even though the official line is that it shouldn't be pursued as a strategy.
And of course, one of the leaders of the hunger strike in Mountjoy was Pather Clancy. We're going to hear more about Clancy later in the show. But how many prisoners were on hunger strike in that strike that takes place in April of 1920? And how long did it go on for?
So the strike begins on the 5th of April and the numbers grow. So it starts with about 60 prisoners on hunger strike, but within a few days there are over 100 prisoners on hunger strike. And, you know, hunger strike is a highly communicative act. It's a great way for prisoners if they want to start a conversation with the prison authorities. And it's an even more effective communicative act if you have widespread support on the outside. In the first place, if there's knowledge about what you're doing on the outside, and then if pressure is being exerted by forces outside as well. And this was the case in April 1920. So Gumun na Mon are organising a significant protest outside the prison. Large crowds are beginning to gather. The Catholic hierarchy officially urges the Dublin Castle to release the prisoners, although they're not exactly sympathetic to the hunger strike as a strategy, but nonetheless they urge release. And then on the 12th of April, the Irish Labour Party and Trade Union Congress approve a general strike for the following day, the 13th of April. And that's very widely observed across at least Southern Ireland and in Dublin. And then that facilitates the gathering of very large crowds outside the prison again. So all this pressure is building up and it reaches the point where Dublin Castle begin to release some of the prisoners on the 14th of April.
Now, across the water in Wormwood Scrubs prison in London, there's also a hunger strike. Tell us a little bit about that as well. And was it connected with Mountjoy or was it inspired by the hunger strike in Mountjoy?
Yeah, there's a definite connection between the two. So in Wormwood Scrubs, there are sort of two hunger strikes in quick succession. There's one which is a very brief one and a very disorganised one in many ways. It lasts really 2 days on the 9th and 10th of April. So in parallel with the hunger strike in Dublin. But the prisoners are divided about whether they should strike or not. And they're particularly divided about why they're hunger striking, because they have an ameliorated internment regime in Wormwood Scrubs. So really they're striking for release, openly striking for release at this point. So that strike stops. And then when there's success in Mountjoy, when it's clear that the Mountjoy prisoners are being released, conversations open up again in Wormwood Scrubs and there's a vote taken among the prisoners on the 18th of April and a majority decide that they should embark upon a hunger strike. There's a significant minority who are against it. Over 60 of the prisoners are against embarking on a hunger strike, but nonetheless, the majority begin the strike. And then over time, as the strike proceeds, the moral pressure grows on the other prisoners to join the strike. And soon the numbers rise. By late April, you have over 200 prisoners on strike in Wormwood Scrubs, almost all of the cohort held there. But also, the authorities make the mistake of transferring 60 prisoners from Belfast into Wormwood Scrubs while the strike is on, and they add numbers to the strike. And eventually, in early May, again, the authorities cede ground and begin to release the prisoners from Wormwood Scrubs. They're very anxious that non-convict prisoners shouldn't die while in prison.
So these were men who were essentially convicted of no crime. So it would have been very, very prejudicial to have had them die in custody.
Absolutely. And, you know, the British are very well aware of the dire propaganda consequences of deaths on hunger strike following the reaction to the Thomas Ashe death on hunger strike in 1917, which was obviously followed by an enormous public political funeral, but also a very public inquest, which had been used as a very effective propaganda tool by Sinn Féin at that point. So there's no way that the cabinet want to see non-convict prisoners die while on hunger strike.
Are there many accounts left by the hunger strikers, by the participants in the hunger strikes, of the day-to-day details of what was going on?
The Mountjoy strike is better recorded by the participants than the Wormwood Scrubs strike. So, for instance, Frank Gallagher, who was a leading figure among the remand prisoners who participated in the Mountjoy strike, he wrote a memoir about it called Days of Fear, and he attempts to evoke the kind of atmosphere on the strike. He represents it very much as a spiritual struggle. He talks about the spiritual pride. He talks about ecstasy. He tries to evoke a kind of a hallucinatory effect that sets in after a short period on hunger strike. So it's a sort of very impressionistic and literary effort to represent the hunger strike. Todd Andrews also leaves quite a lengthy account of the Mountjoy hunger strike. He was on that, and his is much more straightforward, pragmatic, less romantic. In fact, he's quite dismissive of this idea that, you know, this is an example of a great collective effort. He stresses the fact that the moral pressure being imposed upon the prisoners was in effect an order, and that many of the prisoners were on hunger strike because they felt they had no choice. They even felt intimidated into participating.
The strikes were not allowed to continue for they ended within a relatively short space of time. So why did the government give in to the prisoners' demands so quickly?
There's a very good reason for this. They really didn't know how long someone could survive on hunger strike in the spring of 1920. At that stage, medical opinion still thought that it was very likely that the prisoner was in danger as soon as 4 or 5 days on a hunger strike. And as a consequence of that, the medical officers in the prisons generally started to recommend release quite quickly, within 4 or 5 days. The authorities then were not just under pressure from the prisoners, but they were actually under pressure from their own medical officers in many cases to effect a release. And the medical officers were well aware that hunger strikers dying under their care had significant consequences for them. Intimidation was also deployed against medical officers in Dublin, for instance, but also in Cork when hunger strikes begin there later in the summer. They're very well aware that they're likely to lose their income. Many of these medical officers are only part-time prison medical officers, and they have private practices that may go into decline if they're identified as men who have allowed hunger strikers to die. And also, they often tend to have jobs in other state institutions or local government institutions, such as workhouse hospitals or asylums, the asylums across Ireland. And those bodies are increasingly controlled by nationalist boards at this point. And the nationalist boards are likely to remove these men from their posts if they, you know, continue to administer to hunger strikers, and most certainly if they allow hunger strikers to die under their care.
Now, things seem to have changed by August of 1920, because another hunger strike begins in Cork City Jail. 11 prisoners take part, including the Lord Mayor of Cork, Terence McSweeney. McSweeney famously dies, and two others die in that hunger strike. Had British attitudes towards hunger strikers changed between April and August 1920? And if so, why?
Absolutely. So it's very clear in retrospect that the British authorities have firmly decided that they're going to return to their position of spring 1918 at this stage. And they are absolutely going to hold the line from now on. They are going to say to these prisoners, stop or starve. And they mean it this time. In retrospect, it's clear for several reasons. First of all, the authorities are becoming increasingly aware that once more prisons are becoming useless to them. If they can't stop the hunger strikes, if they can't hold prisoners, then there's very little point in deploying lots of resources in arresting and putting on trial or court-martialing men. They're also very conscious that matters have escalated in Ireland. By the summer of 1920, the violence has become much, much worse. And in July 1920, in general, the British cabinet decides to adopt a much more hardline coercive policy in Ireland. Perhaps the best indication of that increased coercive policy is the introduction of the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act in early August 1919, which gives a whole set of increased powers to the military in particular, but more generally to the authority in Ireland in the attempt to crush this rebel activity as they see it.
Now, as we hear from Maura McSweeney Brua, her father, Terence McSweeney, and the other prisoners were prepared to see the strike through to the bitter end.
He said at the time of his arrest that it was illegal. They had no right to arrest the first citizen of the city. And in any case, dead or alive, he would be free in a month. Nobody knew that anybody could remain on hunger strike longer. I think it had never been done. It had never been tested medically.
William, McSweeney didn't stay in Cork City Jail, of course. So where does he end up?
So, yes, McSweeney is arrested the day after the hunger strike begins and he immediately joins it. And then 4 days later, he is convicted. And at his trial, he, you know, insists that he will be released or he will die. He makes it clear his intention to continue his hunger strike. And at that point, he's transferred to Brixton Prison in London. So from that point on, you have two parallel hunger strikes happening, really. You have McSweeney striking in Brixton Jail in London, very close to the international press, very well-known figure. He's a figure of substance because he's the Lord Mayor of Cork, and his hunger strike is achieving a lot of international attention. And then you have the parallel hunger strike in Cork, which is probably less well-known. The figures on that fluctuate over the first fortnight or so, but by late August, it's settled down to 11 determined hunger strikers who are on hunger strike in Cork and are determined to pursue this hunger strike to its end.
And are any attempts made to intervene? Do the prison authorities, for example, do they try and give the prisoners food by means other than force feeding, which obviously had been disastrous in the case of Thomas Ash?
In the case of Cork, the evidence is quite clear that they attempt briefly and I think successfully for a while to surreptitiously give the prisoners some nutrients in their water. But this stops after a period. It seems that the prisoners become aware of what is happening and therefore it stops. There is a good deal of debate about it in the context of McSweeney. Officially, at least, the authorities decide that they are not going to attempt to surreptitiously feed him. They think the danger of him recognising that this is happening are too great. Still, nonetheless, there persist rumours that it did happen. What is clear is that they inform McSweeney that when he no longer remains capable of telling them that they should not feed him, in other words, when he begins to lose consciousness, that at that point they will begin to introduce nutrients to him and they will begin to feed him. And this does happen towards the end of the hunger strike. And by all accounts, McSweeney, who's drifting in and out of consciousness, becomes aware that this is happening and it causes him quite a deal of distress during his final days.
And what's the role, what's the attitude of the Roman Catholic Church in regard to the hunger strikes?
Well, when we get to the McSweeney hunger strike, the role of the Catholic Church is quite significant. You have open public debates taking place in the pages of various theological journals between theologians who represent the hunger strike as potentially suicide, arguing that if anyone was to die while on hunger strike, that in effect they were killing themselves, and theologians who argue the opposite, that the hunger striker is like the soldier who goes into battle. He hopes he doesn't die, but he may in fact die in battle. So these kind of debates are raging in the press and in the theological journals, as I say. Perhaps more importantly, the British diplomatic service are attempting to convince the Pope to intervene, and they're lobbying at the Vatican to try and get the Pope to condemn the hunger striking in Ireland. And this sees a sort of counter campaign being launched in Rome by figures who are sympathetic towards the Irish nationalists. And that counter campaign is quite successful. They convince the Pope not to intervene. So the Pope remains neutral in the matter. Obviously, the Church has a role then in the aftermath. Perhaps one of the most important elements of the hunger strikes when they end in death is the public funeral and all that surrounds that. And obviously, the Church facilitates that both in London, in Southwark Cathedral, in the case of McSweeney, but also in Cork.
Yes, because Joe Murphy, who was on hunger strike in Cork, actually dies, I think, on the same day as Terence McSweeney, and just over a week before, Michael Fitzgerald had also died in Cork. Why do the deaths of Michael Fitzgerald and Joe Murphy not generate the same amount of attention as that of McSweeney to this day?
That's a very interesting question, and it's not so easy to answer. I think part of it, this is because McSweeney is, as I say, you know, the Lord Mayor of Cork. So that means that it brings a particular attention to his efforts. The other factor is that McSweeney is based in London, so that means that he attracts a lot more international press coverage. I think the fact that it's the story of the single martyr in the case of McSweeney, the personal individual story also is attractive for journalists who are attempting to represent what's happening. And so McSweeney achieves attention. The hunger strikers in Cork really don't emerge as individuals as the strike is being conducted. They're consistently represented as a sort of group or a cohort. That changes slightly when they die. So Fitzgerald is the first to die, and there's quite an amount of press coverage of Fitzgerald's death because it's the first. And there's an effort, particularly in the Irish nationalist press, to represent it as a good Christian death. There's an emphasis on the attendance of a priest at his side, his piety, he's being surrounded by his family saying prayers. Murphy is afforded far less attention. He has in some ways the misfortune to die on the same day as McSweeney, and McSweeney consumes all the sort of available press coverage, it seems, and Murphy's death passes almost without attention. It would be a mistake to say there's no attention, but almost without attention.
Now, the Republican leadership obviously achieved a fantastic coup, tragic but fantastic coup, because of the death of McSweeney and slightly less so Fitzgerald and Murphy. But after all of this has played out, what is the attitude of the Republican leadership towards the hunger strike as a tactic?
Following McSweeney's death, I mean, they're conscious of the huge propaganda advantage that has been achieved, particularly in the international press. But they're also very conscious of the high cost, and they're deeply sceptical that the same propaganda advantage can be achieved, a second time, that the achievements can be repeated. And so they firmly return to discouraging hunger strike in the aftermath of the deaths of McSweeney, Murphy and Fitzgerald. And the prison cohorts are far less likely to go on hunger strike in the aftermath of those deaths. The prisoners listen to their leadership to some extent, but also I think they too are now aware that it is quite likely that they are not making a choice between short-term discomfort and release, but they're actually likely making a choice that would lead to their deaths if they embark upon hunger strikes. So hunger strikes are very infrequently used, and they tend to last for very short periods from late 1920 through to the conclusion of the Irish War of Independence. Obviously, they'll be adopted again by Republicans in later phases of conflict, including during the Civil War. But the McSweeney and the Cork hunger strikes are really, in effect, the end of hunger strike as a strategy during the War of Independence.
Clearly seen as too high a price to pay. William, thanks very much indeed for joining us. William Murphy there to talk about the hunger strikes of 1920, a series of events that mirrored the escalating conflict in Ireland, where it seemed neither side would back down, and which would in turn lead to more death and to more tragedy.